Hey, I got a little trivia for you. Maybe you can help me figure this out. Mm-hmm. Been listening to Sirius Satellite XM Radio, which, as you know, the 80s on 8 station is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And something popped up when I was driving home, racing back to do the Grizz with you.
Mm. Well, I will aspire to help you.
Well, I mean, there's some great songs being played today. With some fantastic stuff. And, you know, it's beautiful sunny out right now, so it's got that summer vibe. They were playing some Toto, some Africa, you know. They were playing some good stuff, 1983 stuff, which is always good. And then they played some Breakfast Club. Can you name a good Breakfast Club song?
Well, I don't believe that's a band, right? That's only a movie.
But isn't there a band? I mean, or is it from that soundtrack?
Right. Yeah, it's from the soundtrack, but you know, there were a couple really like classic 80s songs that were on that soundtrack, right?
Right on Track.
Right on Track? That's the name of one of them?
Yeah, actually that is the artist, Breakfast Club. I thought so.
That's news to me.
Yeah, here's the song.
All right, play it.
Wait, maybe I can't hear it this way. I'll pull it up. Right on Track. You know that song, right?
I don't know. Play it. I'll tell you if I know it.
All right, let's see here.
Let's not get sued. Here we go.
Right, I'll try to play a little for you. Here's a little sample. I love that song.
It sounds very familiar.
I've always been a fan of it, and I never knew who it was. One of those, you know, like I never knew who sang it until today, kind of thing.
Right on.
It's got that little. Yeah, here we go. ...1987, but it's from the band Breakfast Club.
I see.
And I didn't
They
know.
Presumably took their name from the popular film.
I would think so. But apparently they only recently released it on iTunes, like about a year or so ago. But I was like, oh, wait, is this the movie? And I'm like, no, wait a second, this is the band. And sure enough, I got all excited. And then right after that, they played a John Lennon song. And I did a double take, because it was Nobody Told Me. Which, you know, do you know that song?
By John Lennon.
Yeah.
Not Julian Lennon.
Yeah, John Lennon.
Right, right.
You know the song I'm talking about, right?
I believe I do.
And I couldn't, I did a double take, because you know how it'll put the text on the screen for what year it is?
Yes.
But it said 1984. Now, correct me if I'm, here's the trivia.
He was kind of dead.
Right, right. Here's the trivia. Was John Lennon still alive in 1984, or when he was shot in 1980, I mean, did he manage to then release songs 4 years later?
Evidently. But, you know, they released a lot of posthumous stuff of his. So, I mean, that's not all that surprising.
But, I mean, that song? I mean, that's a pretty darn famous song, right? I mean,
I think if you made a list of maybe the 10 most famous Lennon solo tunes, I don't think that'd make it.
Really?
I don't think so.
I think that's a pretty darn famous song.
I agree that it's famous. I just don't. I think there are a lot of Lennon solo tunes that precede that.
So I was doing some digging because I was like, all right, wait a second, 1984. What's going on here? Right.
Right.
I don't get this. Well, why is it listed as 1984? Was it some unreleased track that somebody just got their hands on? Kind of like what they did with those Beatles tracks. You know, when
right.
they did the,
sure.
the
"Fly Like a Bird" or whatever. Free
right.
like a bird.
Right, Free Like a Bird, and the other one. And the only thing I can think of that looks like it's, I don't know, it's the one that should be released. It's like the Milk and Honey mix, a Milk and Honey remastered. But I don't know, after a 5-year hiatus, John Lennon hit the recording studio. No, so he recorded this in 1980. So either they were wrong on this,
that's
or
possible.
This is some remix, Milk and Honey remastered. And I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, there are definitely errors like that in the XM Sirius system. I can remember, this is years ago when I had a subscription, at least 7 years ago when I had my XM radio, that the latter 80s Elton John hit Club at the End of the Street, which is one of my favorite Elton John songs, was erroneously titled Club at the End of the Night. And I called the XM radio people about getting it fixed, and they were like, oh, that's impossible. Once it's in the system, we don't know how to fix it. And there were other errors like that, that like I'd see it come up wrong on the display. And that was the most common one, actually, was the year. The years were often wrong. and I'd call to correct them, and they'd just be like, yeah, we don't, you know, we're just the low people here. Like, only one guy can talk to the computer brain that runs everything.
There's like one guy, you know, it's at the end of his shift, right? Mm-hmm. He's got to head home. He doesn't certainly want to have to deal with rewiring the system because some guy calls.
Right. I think that's what it would be, wiring.
Right.
Like, this Elton John title's wrong. Get the wires.
Yeah, go. Hey, put the yellow one in the analog hole. Maybe that'll fix it. No, I mean, Milk and Honey, by the way, is an album of his, but
yes.
Of course. But, you know, maybe it was the remastered version of this album that somehow came out in 1984, which seems odd, right? Because you don't remaster albums in 1984. Or am I wrong? I mean, did they release remasters on vinyl?
I think so. I think so. I want to say this about, you know, obviously it's changed since the merger, and I got out, you know. I was solely XM. I was anti-Sirius. I got out when they got in bed together, but I remember this, in the early days of satellite radio, when I think they were not as common as they are now, and I mean this like 7, 8, or 9 years ago when I had one in my car, which might have been the only technological trend I was sort of in front of.
Yeah. Yeah, you were well out in front of that on me. I mean, you were, because I never knew much, if anything, about it.
Yeah. What I loved about it was, you know, whatever they had, 100 stations, give or take. If you called in when it was live, you know, sometimes the programming wasn't live. It was like a loop of what had been played earlier in the day or whatever. You could get a request on, like, in a matter of seconds, which was amazing to me. You know, I would just call up and name some random 80s tune to test them, and then it would be the next song coming up. And that, you know, and
it's amazing,
especially 80s stuff, you know, since we know some more obscure material, like that was really fun to kind of test them. And I was always amazed. This is during a time when Chikara Wrestle Factory, which is the pro wrestling training school where I teach aspiring pro wrestlers, when it was still located in Philadelphia, it was, I was driving down there one day, was stuck in Philly traffic, and I kept calling back and changing my name and requesting new songs just to see how fast I could get them on as a way to amuse myself in the traffic. And so I got a couple obscure ones on, like One Night in Bangkok by Murray Head. And you know, there's that other version of Funky Town. Like, you know, there's the one by Lips Inc., which is the more famous one. But there's also one by like Pseudo Echo that's not quite as famous. You know, like weird stuff like that. So on one of these, using the pseudonym Claudio from Switzerland, I requested The Touch by Stan Bush.
Did it get on?
Which, as you know, like that was not in the top 20. Like, even though to children of the 80s, that song is like immortal, in terms of like chart success or like number of units moved, it is not like a blockbuster hit by any stretch of the imagination. And they said, oh, we wouldn't play that on this station. The 80s station wouldn't play The Touch by Stan Bush, which was from 1986. And I was really caught up. Why? Why? You're the 80s station.
Right.
Why wouldn't you play that? And instead they said, no, you'd have to call this other channel, you know, which whatever did like obscure alternative hits or something. They would play it on their format. We couldn't play it on the 80s station. I thought that was really bizarre.
They wouldn't allow it? They're like, no, we've got – it was like flagged. It showed up. It was like a red dot. No, we can't. Sorry. Absolutely not. We're not allowed to play that.
Right. I just thought that was really peculiar. Like if the only thing that should define what's played – by your station would be that it was released and or popular during the 1980s, right? Like that should be the only criteria, and they wouldn't play that, which I thought was really peculiar.
That's funny.
I want to tell you this too, because I don't know where else I would offload this story, but
and here, get it off your chest right here. This is why we gather up on the Grizz.
You know, it was whatever it was now, I don't know, 2 years ago when we first had Stan Bush as a guest here on the Grizz. He made a couple appearances in quick succession, maybe two or three spaced out by a dozen or so episodes, give or take. And since his appearances here, I've been very fortunate to befriend him. And he even came and Clayton and I got to see him perform live at Chikara's King of Trios fan conclave. And I've been fortunate enough to stay in touch with him. And he was really excited. He was telling me that he has an upcoming gig at The Greek in L.A.,
really?
Oh, where he is
nice.
Yeah, where he's playing with REO Speedwagon, Styx, and Ted Nugent. He's kind of the opener. And nothing fast. I shouldn't say that. But one of the things that fascinates me, it captures my imagination, is like the thought process behind how artists assemble their set lists for concerts. And, you know, Clayton and I, we've seen a number of acts together live over the years, right? We saw David Byrne at the Electric Factory together. You and I both saw Sting in Newark together, right? Right, or Camden. I said Newark, but I meant Camden. Right on the waterfront, right?
Right.
The one that Natalie Merchant opened?
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah.
What other ones have we seen together? I'm trying to think. We were at the Police reunion concert, I think, at the same time, but not near each other.
No. I that was, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that was your wedding present from me.
That's right. Clayton and his wife went.
Yeah.
That was the wedding gift. Yeah, it was really strange. I thought we should have been included. But other than that...
No, you and your wife went. Yeah, but it was in Philadelphia at Citizens Bank Park.
Right. We saw Tears for Fears most recently.
Right.
We went to that. I don't know what other ones we've seen. We've seen a handful of shows together. But I think that's something like we love to debate and discuss on our way out. Like, why did they pick this song? You know, or why didn't they play that one?
Right, and I think universally we agreed, like, how awesome Tears for Fears was. I mean, all the songs that they chose to play, spot on. There was not one you wish they would have played.
Right.
At least in my mind, I couldn't think, like, run down the ones that I was like, oh, I wish they would have played this. They played everything I wanted to hear.
Yes, they did not play one song too many, which I think is a rare thing. But, you know, like David Byrne, for example, or Sting's another great one where, you know, you're going to get a mix of, like, the stuff that they made famous with their band. And then, but of course, especially for Clayton and I, like, we're fans of them as solo artists, so we want to hear the solo stuff, too. We don't want that to take a back seat. But, you know, they're going to play their most commercially recognized hits, of course, even, you know, I'm sure, like, I doubt very much that, like, Clayton goes to a Sting show hoping to hear Every Breath You Take again.
Right.
You know, in the same way, like, I don't need Once in a Lifetime when I go to see a David Byrne show or a Psycho Killer or, like, one of the other standards that always seems to creep into his sets. So, what was interesting is I was having this conversation as Stan was telling me about this upcoming gig that he has at the Greek Theater. And the Greek Theater was also the site, as we discussed, I think just a grizz ago, of that famous 86 Monkeys reunion where Papa Nez joined the other three on stage and played Pleasant Valley Sunday and listened to the band. He had remarked to me, he said, I don't think I'm going to play The Touch.
Ouch.
And I said, why? Like, why is that? And he had some other, you know, other good stuff that he wanted to play, more recent stuff.
Was he going all artist-y on you?
No, he's so not that guy. Like, he's so down to earth.
You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying when I say that, right?
Well,
like,
yes,
oh,
but
you know.
That's what I thought at first. I thought, because that song is, like, the most associated song with him, is he going through one of those things where, like, he doesn't want to play it? Like, he's at odds with what that represents in terms of his career. You know, like, has he grown to resent the fact that when, you know, people are introduced to him, that's of course the only thing that they know is The Touch. And that was my first instinct. Like, is that what's going on? So, you know, he's going to perform by himself. It's going to be an acoustic set, which he's been doing a lot of lately. Like, he's got a side band called the Acoustic Saints, and he's been doing a lot of, like, just low key acoustic gigs, but where he accompanies himself on guitar and that sort of thing. And he's picked out a lot of his, like, more recent material, which is great because, like, some of his recent stuff is very worthy of all the critical acclaim that it's gotten. And I think he's really delighted that people are recognizing something other than those songs about robots that he's done. But, yeah, I was fascinated by this. So I couldn't let that go, you know? Like, there was no way that I was going to let that slide. And I said, why? Like, what are you thinking there? And he said, well, maybe I have to play, like, just a snippet of it because that's what people know, but I don't know that I should play the whole thing. And so I argued with him a little bit about it. And I said, I know you're not asking for my advice here necessarily, you know, other than it was nice of you to, you know, share with me what your intended set list was and what you've been rehearsing, because this gig's really important to him.
Right.
He doesn't play out a whole lot anymore in this type of setting, you know, with the likes of Styx and REO Speedwagon and, you know, guys that headline big grossing tours and go all over the country every single year like Styx and REO do. And I said, I think you have to, you know, whether whether that's what you want to do or not, because I said, for some people, that even if they don't know his name, they know that song.
Right.
They've heard it somewhere. That song creeps into all kinds of different weird places, and it's loaded into your pop culture subconscious, whether you realize it or not. And I said, for the people that know that song but not your name, that's what brings it home. Like, that's who you are. That's your signature tune. You know, he co-wrote that with Lenny Macaluso back in the 80s. And I said, but you have to realize, like, part of the reason that song endures the way that it does is because it really does speak to people. Like, there is something about the message of that song that you don't hear in a lot of other popular music that really resonates very powerfully with people. And it resonated with Clayton and I when we were kids. But it's tough not to hear a song like that and get a little pumped up. And I said, I think for people who don't know who you are and have never heard your brand of music, that's not the kind of thing you can leave in the back pocket. Like, you've got to put that on the table. You have to leave that on stage. And I persuaded him that that was the way to go. And that was such a strange moment of, like, nerd triumph that I experienced.
I know. I was secret. I'm listening to the story, like, biting my fingers because I'm did he come through in the end? Like, never-ending story. Like, I wanted to know if Atreyu was going to make it or not against the nothing. Did you manage to overcome the nothing?
Yeah. So after we were done having the chat, he said, you're right. He's like, of course I have to do it. And I felt like...
like the song should have come on just then, right?
That intro, the synth intro. So, right. I was like, wow. I did something today. But that whole thing fascinates me. I would love, a couple episodes ago, we had John Flansburgh on the program. Did Clayton and I? We were lucky enough that one half of our favorite musical duo, They Might Be Giants, were on the show. And if we had him, we only had him. How long do you think he was on? 30 minutes.
Yeah, 30 minutes or so. Yeah,
right. Like, if he'd said, you know what, I think I could probably carve out 2 hours for you. Like, that type of stuff fascinates me. I would love to ask him, like, what is the thought process behind, you know, this set list, or what is the thought process behind the way you ordered the tracks on this album? Like, I love knowing that kind of stuff. And that's not out there. Like, there isn't, like, a wealth of that type of stuff to dig through.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because I often think, like, how when the flow, right, and they come out on stage, they're coming out with something. You know, like, Sting would come out for his brand new day tour, and he'd play 1,000 Years. Mm-hmm. It's a very slow song.
Right, it creeps up on you.
And he just comes out almost in the shadows and starts playing this with the, you know, his bass, and he comes out and starts going into it. And it's very beautiful. It's an interesting way to start the concert, right? Because then he's like, all right, now we're going to kick it up a notch. We come out with a slow song, and you kind of give me enough rope to hang me with because you know me, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not Stan Bush necessarily. I'm not trying to have a comeback. So you don't want to, you know, if it was Stan, you almost think like, hey, come on out and play the touch first.
Right.
Right, you know, come right out and knock them out, and then be like, that's mm-hmm. who this guy is, you know.
That's right.
Instead of finishing with it, I think the tendency is to finish with it. But so Sting comes out and plays a slow song at this one concert that I saw, and then he comes right in with All This Time, you know, which is mm-hmm. an upbeat, or If You Love Somebody, Set Them Free, like a big, you know, a big hit next, so you recognize it, and it's upbeat and up tempo. And then they always get into that, like, sort of middle period of their set where it's like three slow songs,
mm-hmm.
where it's. If you had one of those applications, I don't know if you ever saw this app. My wife loves it. For going to the movie theater, it's called, like, I Have to Pee or something like that. Hmm. And you launch the app, and it tells you, like, if you're going to see, you know, a movie, it tells you at what point in the movie to go to the bathroom.
This is a marvel of science.
It's a great app. It's been out for like 2 years, and so
is it $99.99?
No, I don't know if it might even be free. It might be 99 cents or something.
Whose genius is being handed out for free?
I don't know. It might have ads in it. You know, it might have movie ads in it or something. But
for beverages, I hope.
Nevertheless, I mean, how genius is that, right? You download the app and you know, there's 2 points within this movie where it's just going to be some little slow scene. And that's kind of what I wish they had for concerts, right? You know, if you're going to go see David Byrne in this new concert that he's launching, okay, about 8 songs in, he's going to play a song you don't really care to hear.
Right.
And you can kind of hold off on going to the bathroom until that point, you know? Mm-hmm. But it's always as if you can tell the songs that they stuck in there for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the song, especially if you're seeing like a greatest hits kind of band.
Yeah.
And the songs that they know that they're playing just for you.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, for the very first time, I felt like a concert that I saw where it felt like the whole concert was for him was Sting, his most recent concert tour, his Back to Base tour.
Right.
And as a fan of Sting's music, I loved it. because it was all the stuff I don't get to hear in a concert.
Weird stuff, yeah, the unusual choices.
And I loved it, and it was really interesting stuff. He played like he played a couple of country songs back to back, which I really enjoyed. You know, and he talked quite a bit about why he loves that genre so much, and all of that meant so much more to me than him just playing like greatest hits with a few filler songs that he knows that were just on the new album that he has to work in to make his band happy so they don't get bored. Then you come back with Every Breath You Take at the end of the set, you know.
Yeah, when I saw Lindsey Buckingham in Reading a couple summers ago, it was the same way. Like, you really got the vibe that he did not care what, you know, people wanted to hear. This was the set designed to please him.
Right.
And he did. He spoke at length sometimes about, like, the meanings of the songs, and, which is cool, right? Like, that's why you go to a concert. You want to hear that direct from the artist. But after the fact, I might have even told this anecdote on The Grizz after seeing him. After his stop in Reading, which is where I saw him, he also played at the TLA in Philadelphia, and I happened to be friends with some of the people that are the crew there that work, you know, whether it's lights or sounds or stage or security or things like that. And they said, like, one thing that is he's within the music industry notorious for is that even his own people that travel with him hate Lindsey Buckingham. Like, they said, he's so full of himself, and he's just so difficult to deal with that, like, even the people that you would think would have become his best friends over the years from being on the road, like, they just hate him. And, like, when I reflected on, like, listening to him talk and, like, just kind of like the way he mastered the stage the night before in Reading, I was like, yeah, I could kind of see that. I could kind of see that. But let me say that about a lot of the people, right, because – you catch, I don't know where, right, other than Stuart Copeland, I don't know who would come out and say this kind of thing, but you know there are people out there that would love to rag on, like, how difficult Sting is to deal with. Like, you know that there's a plethora of interviews out there where people just talk about, like, how prickly Lindsey Buckingham is. There's all kinds, from ex-bandmates to you name it, who talk about how impossible David Byrne is to deal with. And yet, in spite of this, like, those are our favorite artists.
Right.
Like, you have to allow for a level of that prickly eccentricity, I think, to really get to the types of creative output that those people give you.
Yeah. And you know, I like those kind of guys, right?
Right. That's why you and I have gotten along so well over the years.
Right. We like those prickly guys. Or you might call them pricks. I mean, it's sort of like what I love about Steve Jobs, right? Mm-hmm. My wife and I were talking about this the other day, actually, how there are individuals who, you know, they're big dreamers. We were talking about Dr. Wayne Dyer's new book called Wishes Fulfilled, and she and I are both reading it right now, and we're both about four chapters into it. And the idea is that, you know, sort of ideas for manifesting and anything that you think about can, you know, become reality in this way. And he leads off the book by talking about a girl who he met on the beach, a girl, her mom, and I guess their grandmother, and they were on this trip to Maui, and he just happened to meet them on the beach. And she, 2 weeks earlier, was diagnosed with Bell's palsy, this girl. Sure. She's like 20 years old or so. And suddenly she just woke up with, like, facial paralysis in a very severe case. Doctor said she would likely never recover. She couldn't go to sleep without, like, taping her eye shut and putting an ointment because you have no control over your, like, one side of her body. So she couldn't eat. She couldn't blink, you know, anything. Her eye would get dried out. Horrible, horrible. And so they actually sat down and went back to Wayne's condo and just sat down and just talked for, like, an hour. And he literally was having her believe that she was, like, paralysis-free. And she was saying, like, I am paralysis-free. And by the end of the hour of, like, deep meditation and discussion about believing that, you know, she left and, you know, had gone to bed that night, woke up and still had the paralysis. But over the next few days, began to fully believe that she was paralysis-free, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, family members would be sending her literature on Bell's palsy. And she would say, no, don't you understand? I am paralysis-free. Even though, if, like, her friends were like, no, you're not. Your face is still, like, half of it's working. And then, like, a few days later, she woke up and she was paralysis-free. Gone. Completely gone. Back to normal. And so he recounts this story in this letter that then the mom wrote to him, recounting the story. And it's these people he talks about who are sort of like Steve Jobs, these sort of big dreamer types, who can have this – you almost get a sense of arrogance from them. Mm-hmm. But they're – maybe they are, maybe they aren't, but who cares? Like, they know their way, right? Mm-hmm. And they're not sort of asking for permission to do big things. And Dr. Wayne Dyer talks about these average thinkers, these people who literally just always settle for average. And those are the people that, you know, are the ones that get disease, the ones that just take things that, you know, that you get old and, you know, you have these things happen to your body, like old age and all this sort of thing, where you die of natural causes, those sorts of ideas. And he says it's the other thinkers. It's sort of the higher level thinkers. And I don't know, it's interesting because it was sort of the Steve Jobs analogy, sort of, the, I guess, the prick, the prick in all of us.
I would like to die by dinosaur, not by natural causes. And I am a bit of a dreamer.
You are a dreamer.
I just wanted to put that out there. Hey, so recently here on The Grizz, very recently, Clayton and I, as we tend to do, we took a little stroll down memory lane.
Yeah.
And this stroll down memory lane resulted in my pal Clayton got for me, for my 36th and most awful birthday. I was dumbfounded upon examining it with my own two eyes, as I think I last held one in my hands about 27 years ago.
Yeah.
He found for me what they call the MOC, Mint on Card, 1984 Secret Wars Falcon action figure.
Isn't that crazy?
That it is crazy. What's crazy is that it looks like it just came off a store shelf today.
Yeah.
Like, who kept this in such remarkable condition and was like, I'm going to just hang on to this for 27 years? And then what? Was it on eBay? Is that how you found it?
Yeah, and I found it on eBay. And remarkably, and here's what's more remarkable about it, is that the there were two that I found on eBay.
Mm-hmm.
One of which was this one, which was in mint condition, right? I mean, the box, you know, except for like maybe a slightly tufted corner. Is in perfect condition, and I don't know how. Again, I don't know how a sort of seed vault this guy had this thing in it, like Antarctica
seed vault.
You know, like I don't know where he kept this thing. That it was a Secret Wars action figure is in that perfect a condition, but it was amazing. And then the other one that I saw, some guy had, and it was like yellowed, like all the plastic was completely yellowed, like someone had urinated on it.
Yes,
and then sat it out in the sun for a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that is why you'll remember during our heyday as hardcore comic book collectors that the acid-free bags became all the rage, because some of the bags that things were being stored in, mostly comic books, but also by virtue of that, comic book collectors would store other things like action figures in them, they would cause the contents to yellow.
Right.
So it's maybe that. You know, the guy, when he got it in 84, thought, I'm going to put this in a bag and board like I would anything else to preserve it. But, in reality, that didn't help.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know where he kept these. Maybe he kept them in a darkened room somewhere, you know, and just figured he was going to unload them years later and make a pretty penny. And he was right about that.
Yeah. Well, certainly he didn't keep it out in the sun, you know, because the cards would have showed. You remember this, like you'd go to like a West Coast Video or whatever, and was the front row in the store, which was exposed to the sunlight coming in through the windows, like all of those, you know, the colors had been bleached, sun bleached out.
Right.
Like, you can always tell when something has been left in the sun like that, like a VHS tape or a Secret Wars figure from 1984.
Right. Or, you know, you got a picture on your wall. You take it down if you're moving, and like where the sun was shining through the wall, there's like a perfectly, you know, there's a square where you just took the picture off the wall. It was remarkable to look at those action figures. And then, of course, when I got it and held it in my hand, I couldn't believe, like you remarked on the back, like some of the other characters whose photos, you know, you want to buy the other ones, right?
Of course. Hobgoblin was back there.
Yeah. And I forgot which series. Now, there were, what, two series or three?
There was definitely two. You know, the first series had the mainstays. That was Spidey and Iron Man and Cap, Doctor Doom, Doc Ock, Magneto, Kang, those types. And then there was the second series is where you had the black-costumed Spider-Man, Daredevil. I'm guessing the Hobgoblin, right? Zemo. So was the third series the one that had Falcon, Iceman, and Constrictor? Because those are the three super rare ones from that. I don't know. So I don't know if that was like the second set, but like, you know how sometimes they're packed so that you only get one, you might get 10 Spider-Mans in the box, but you only get one Falcon.
Right.
I don't know if that was why he was so rare, or if it was like because the third series, you know, it was dying by then, and maybe it wasn't getting the distribution. Maybe that's why they were so rare. I don't know. Like, but I tell you who probably does know. I don't know if you caught this, but you know our editor here at Grizzly Productions, Jim Metzendorf,
right,
is a huge Secret Wars fan.
I didn't realize that. So
if you want to, this is rare. We never allow him to do this. If you want to intersperse your voice here, Jim, with a little information for us, and then when we listen to it live, we'll know. You can tell us, was the Falcon Constrictor Iceman Wave 3 or a less sordid Wave 2? We'll await your inserted post-production commentary, Jim.
And in the meantime, so we'll look for that, and we'll take a little break here, and we'll come back and see if Jim's voice made it into the show or not. See if he catches that. See what kind of an editor he is.
Yeah, if I were him, I wouldn't listen to this show.
Yeah, I know.
Wow, I can't believe I get to be on a podcast with Shepard Smith and Hulk Hogan. This is so cool. Hey guys, Jim here. I just wanted to clarify what Mike was saying about the Secret Wars action figures. The Falcon was part of the second wave of figures that was available here in the United States. What's interesting about those is of all of the characters in that wave, except for Spider-Man in his black costume, none of the characters were even in the Secret Wars comic book. So you had the Falcon wasn't in Secret Wars. You had black costume Spidey, and you had Baron Zemo, Daredevil, and Hobgoblin. So that was the second wave of figures, and those were the last figures that you could get in the United States. Now, there were three more figures that were produced, but they were produced in smaller quantities. By then, interest in the comic book had kind of come and gone, so Mattel produced a run of these figures, but not enough of them to warrant a release in the United States. So the following three figures you could only get in foreign markets, and they are very rare: Iceman, Constrictor, and Electro. If you ever run across those, grab them if you can, because they are very, very rare. Another thing that's really interesting about the Secret Wars figures and all action figure toys of that era, if you're dealing with unopened ones, the bubble, the clear plastic that holds the figure onto the card, is much more likely to be yellowed than figures from previous eras. So actually, if you look at Star Wars figures, going back to the late 70s with figures on the original Star Wars card, or around 1980 with the Empire Strikes Back wave of figures, those ones are actually much more likely to have a nice clear bubble than figures from the mid to late 80s. Apparently, plastics companies were experimenting with different chemicals, whatever, and the composition of those bubbles is such that yellowing is far more common. So if you've got an unopened Secret Wars figure and it's not a yellow bubble, if it's a nice clear bubble, that's a really, really special figure that you want to hang on to. So anyways, hope that clears it up, guys. Thanks for letting me jump in. And here's Mike to tell you about Gazelle.com.
We are going to take a moment, though, and thank our great show sponsor and friends over at Gazelle.com, who have been revamping what they do. Now is a great time to go over and see them. That's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. They are revamping the way that they do things over there. Of course, you can expect to get more of the same great service that we've been telling you about here at Grizzly Productions for quite a while, because that part of their game certainly isn't changing. But you know, Clayton, this so-called new iPad, which the kids are calling iPad 3, and they refuse to call it new iPad, is what everybody seems to want, except people who have iPad 2.
Right.
If you want to upgrade your gizmo, gadget, or other thing, or you just want to take the stuff that you don't use and you want to convert it into money, you should go over and see our friends over at Gazelle.com, because what they do is, based on the information you tell them, takes you all of a minute to describe the item and the condition it's in. They're going to make you an offer for your good, and everything worth more than $1 qualifies for free shipping over at Gazelle.com. They'll buy it back from you. They'll wipe it of your personal information, or if you've got a bunch of junk, they'll recycle it in an eco-friendly way for you. They are your one-stop shop. They take great care of us. Both Clayton and I have personally unloaded lots of stuff through Gazelle.com. We wouldn't talk about them if we didn't love them, and indeed we do. When
yeah.
you go over there to see them, they may ask you, how did you hear about us? And it's very important that you say, from Grizzly Productions.
Yeah, indeed. Or just click on, I think there it'll even say Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe in the little podcast drop-down menu. So, yeah, thank you know, you can thank them that way.
Interestingly,
they actually, because you talked about they totally revamped stuff over at Gazelle. They said they've simplified everything.
Yes.
So that now they have, you know, they're focused on smartphones, Apple products, and some of the bigger, you know, bigger Android releases and things like that. They've gotten rid of, like, all of the other extraneous stuff, I think.
I see.
They said that they listened to the audience, and the audience said, hey, you know, we're not interested in, like, unloading DVDs and stuff. We're interested in these specific things, and then that way you can give us more money for it. So I guess that's what they're doing. But, yeah, so anyway, they're giving the extra incentives right now for the iPad. So go over and check them out. We thank them for their support of this show. Hey, I found an article. I'm about to send it to you because I think you'll find this fascinating. And I here in New Jersey, we have a newspaper that I don't read, but it's the sort of local New Jersey paper, the New Jersey Star-Ledger.
I've heard of that.
You heard of this? And I saw it when I was at Starbucks. They had a big pile of the Sunday version of the paper,
unsold.
There was a few, but you know, I actually see a lot of people reading them. And there's actually a decent like NewJersey.com app, I think, which is like they own a couple of papers here in the state, apparently. And you ever see like some restaurants around New Jersey? It'll say, you know, Star Ledger says we're the best pizza in New Jersey, or that. So they have some pride. Anyway,
there New York Times readers refer to the Star Ledger as the old gray jerk,
right? The old rag. The old hag. So anyway, I caught this. It was a big cover story about concerts in New Jersey. Anyway, I sent you the article. I think you'd find it interesting, and I just started to scratch the surface of it. But apparently some secret records were leaked to the Star Ledger, or they were legally obtained somehow, after a long legal battle between the New Jersey Sports and Exposition Authority. They gave sort of a behind-the-scenes look at their business, and what they wanted, I guess they leaked it because they wanted to show how ridiculous the demands are from performers and concert promoters. So the whole sort of expose on this thing is that, for instance, like they talked about Britney Spears, you know, playing to 15,000 fans. It had like she sold out the Izod Center. It had, you know, fireworks and all sorts of setup and everything. But apparently it was like hundreds of thousands of dollars in fees, and ticket sales ran for that one particular concert up to $1.75 million for the Britney Spears event. The Izod Center takes about $80,000 in rental fees. Then along with a $3.50 per ticket facility charge. Then they have parking. They made $66,000 from people parking. Concessions, they made $45,000. Then Live Nation, which is the – how would you describe Live Nation? Are they
– I'm not expert enough to really say.
Tour promoter, I guess you would call them?
Yeah, possibly. I don't want to get that wrong, but go ahead. I get the gist of what you're saying.
$76,000 Live Nation took. Then expenses, including like parking lot attendance that you pay out for, $9,000. Security, an additional $15,000. The Sports Authority, I guess, which I don't know how they are involved. The Sports Authority, I guess they're the one that sponsored it. They made a total of $170,000. That was their total profit. So the $1.75 million, and all of that, their only profit was $170,000 after all of those things. Does that seem like it jives with what you've experienced with Chikara?
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that at all. You know, I kind of think – you think about several episodes ago, we had a kind of lengthy discussion just precipitating the arrival of Clark Datchler, frontman of 80s one-hit wonder band Johnny Hates Jazz, on the program. We talked about how difficult it is for artists like that. You know, you kind of imagine that they right, that's why they fade away. They made their money on that one big hit, and they're off somewhere in a mansion, and you'll never see them again. And like, wow, that's probably so not the case. Like, the trickle-down from all of that, like – yeah, like, it really isn't anywhere near what people imagine, and for reasons just like that. You know, there's so much in terms of the logistics and everything else. There's so many people's jobs, you know, and income are based on one event like that, right? From the parking attendants to the security people to the people at the concession stand to the crew. You know, you think about that. Like, all those people have to be paid, and when it's all said and done, you know, a concert event that, what do you say, $1.75 million was grossed, but a profit of just over $100,000?
Yeah, ticket sales. $175 million in ticket sales.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, if I think I understand Live Nation well enough, is that you have groups like that, conglomerates or what have you, that kind of they control certain groups of artists. You know, they might sign into an exclusive deal with them for a while, and they place their concerts all over. So, you know, Live Nation might have their fingers in 200 different venues across the United States, and they get an act like, you know, if Britney Spears was promoted by Live Nation, you know, she might say, I want to do a summer tour, and I'm going to go out on the road, and I want you to fill in 50 dates for me. And so that they, you know, they would go to the venues that they have their fingers in there, you know, where it's appropriate. They might say, all right, well, you know, Britney Spears is going to draw, like, what did you say, 15,000 people?
Was right, that the number? Yeah, 15,000.
Right, so, you know, of those 200 venues, well, maybe only 30 of them are really appropriate sized for her, and then they've got to go out and negotiate deals for the other dates, or they've got to, you know, there's all that logistical stuff, right? Can we bring her into a smaller venue? How does that impact ticket prices? Do we want to risk going into a much larger venue, but we close off the upper mezzanine because we don't want all these empty seats when we have our performer there? It looks empty. It's a bad reflection on them and a bad reflection on the promoter. You know, there's all those types of issues that go into making something like that happen. And all that type of logistical information is always very fascinating to me, not just because of, you know, my experience coming up through the wrestling business and trying to learn all the various aspects that go into a live performance like that, but also because, you know, we are so intrigued by all the nuts and bolts of the music industry, especially as we've talked about everything from the psychology to assembling a concert set list to the profitability of a Britney Spears show on this episode.
Yeah. Hey, did you catch, I don't know what else you were thinking of this week. I just had some notes of things I wanted to chat with you about since we last mm-hmm.
Did you get my note, do you like me?
I did. I wrote you back. I put you down in my slam book.
Slam book.
I haven't heard about a slam book in a long time. Remember those?
Nope.
You get those, remember those like assignment books that we used to get? They're like green, that we used to get in elementary school or junior high, and you write your assignments down in them.
Yeah, I mean, I have an understanding. I didn't know they were called slam books.
No, you would grab them, and you would, you wouldn't use them for assignments. You know, there was always extra, so you would grab one, and you would write, like, a little bit about you. I think you would say, you know, you like me. You would just go through this whole series. I have to pull up, like, an Urban Dictionary and how this thing works here. Slam book.
Oh, you don't even know? Are you making this up?
No, I'm trying to remember the exact flow of it. Slam book. Slam book was a spiral notebook with the name junior, senior high school girl, usually written on the top line. The book is passed along among classmates who write nasty things. They slam on the page under the girl's name. So you'd write, like, you'd start it off by saying, you know, Michelle Quackenbush.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd hand it around the school, and you would say, you know, oh, she's such a whatever, and you know, oh, I'd like to go out with her, and you'd like, you know, you'd
that's
hope
not a slam. Well, I'd like to go out with her. How's that a slam?
I don't know. They can sort of slam their own opinions down of it. I don't know that I ever had one written about me though.
But, right. So what is the end of the slam book? They give it to the person in question.
Yeah, I think you end up just handing it to the person in question.
I see.
So that by the end of it, they're like, oh, someone's handing this around. Like, there's all these people written nasty things on you on the page. Kids are cruel. No wonder,
wow.
No wonder kids are doing stuff to themselves. Anyway.
This phenomenon is unknown to me. You've really opened my eyes to something.
I know. You didn't know what the band Breakfast Club, and you didn't know about slam books? You need to brush up on your 80s, my friend.
Obscure 80s bands especially. That's strange that you catch me with the pants down on that.
No, but hey, there are a couple things I saw this week. I saw a trailer I thought you might find interesting. Have you heard of this new trailer? And I was watching it on the iPad app, that Trailers app. And
Prometheus?
Chernobyl. Chernobyl Diaries. Did you hear about this?
No.
Some idea called like extreme vacationing. Have you heard of this trend? Which I've never heard of.
Right, that's what I need. A vacation with more stress.
Right. I think any vacation you take is extreme. But the people will, like, they go to like bizarre locations to put their lives in peril. So like this group of like, I don't know, post college, you know, kids or whatever, decide they're going to go on an extreme vacation to Chernobyl and get like a bit of a tour there. Mm. And it's quite fascinating. It's almost like it's like documentary style.
Uh-huh.
And it's cool. Like they get there and it's abandoned and this guy is sort of like showing them where the reactor was and the town and all these buildings. And I think they actually shot it there from what I was reading. But then like this, you know, girl takes a photo of one of these abandoned buildings where the workers used to work, and she sees like something in a photo in the window, like that there's something there, you know, and it just creeps you out.
Like a broom.
Yeah, a broom and a dustpan.
Like a dustpan.
Like someone decided to clean this place up.
All right.
There's some
scary.
Sort of.
I got goosebumps just thinking about that dustpan.
You don't even know what it was. You don't know if it's a creature. You know if it's an amalgamation of a dustpan and a creature.
Right.
You don't know what it is.
They were fused together in the accident.
But there are a couple things.
That platypus has a dustpan for a face.
Get your
what are you going to come up with next, J.J. Abrams?
Get your Geiger counter. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it was a J.J. Abrams production, but it's not. But have you seen the new image released for The Arrow?
I did, yes. That's crazy that came up. I saw that minutes before we jumped on the call, actually.
Really?
Was that photo of what Oliver Queen Green Arrow is going to look like in the new CW series. Which is that for the fall? Is that when that's coming?
I think so. Although, I don't know. They've been mixing stuff up, and I thought that Smallville was like a summer show. Am I wrong
Could
about
be.
That?
You might be right. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know when this is. I don't know when this is starting. So yeah, this is the. Yeah, it's the Arrow is the same. I guess executive producer team, director, executive producer who did Smallville.
Right. I think even the pilot's written by the same person who wrote the Smallville pilot. I could be wrong, but.
Here's what David Nutter describes it as. And it's cool because it's like him in shadows and the sort of the green hooded sweatshirt with the arrows sticking out on his back. He says, when I directed the pilot for Smallville, I knew that making Clark Kent relatable would be the key to audiences believing in him as a hero. Arrow is a different show, darker, harder edge, but it's the same core idea. We're creating a real, believable world in which Oliver Queen can do incredible things. Colin Atwood's great work on the Arrow costume reflects that effort. So this is the promotional photo they've released, which is cool.
Right, yeah. It's very much like it is in the vein of the Green Arrow costume that you know from Smallville that Justin Hartley wore. Why they didn't think to get him back to do it, I don't know. He was very good in that role. And it certainly seems reminiscent of that Green Arrow long bow hunters era for the character. You know, like he doesn't have like that little hat, that like Silver Age Justice League,
right.
How to describe that, like scout leader hat.
Right.
He doesn't have that going on.
Like he's not a member of a Fife Corps with a little flute and he's parading.
Fife Corps. Yeah.
Peter Pan.
Exactly. So, right, yeah. And Green Arrow has had a couple different looks over the years, you know. But I'm intrigued by this. Green Arrow is so, like, C-list. You know, it always kind of, you know, you wonder, like, I think it, of course, is because the character was so popular in Smallville. That's how this ended up coming to be. But I don't know how well you remember this, but in the late 90s, basically after The Flash was canceled by CBS, and that happened, what, in 1991 it was canceled?
Yeah, you'd know better than I.
There were a couple efforts to bring a live-action Justice League to television because I really do think this is what it was. They spent each of those Flash suits, I think they made four. For John Wesley's ship, for the live-action TV series is what I'm talking about. Each of those, if memory serves, was like $130,000.
God, how do you find fabric that expensive?
Is this made out of diamonds?
I think it was made of foam, too, like if I'm not mistaken.
It was made out of like an experimental scuba diving outfit, actually, or something like that. But anyway. And, you know, then The Flash was, when it was on, until the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles came along a year or two later, it was the most expensive per episode show on television, was The Flash. So CBS or whomever had invested all this money into The Flash. And when The Flash flopped in terms of the ratings, and there's a variety of reasons for that that we won't get into right now, they tried to bring the Justice League to TV with The Flash as, like, the core character. And the end result of this is, if you were wondering, the oft-bootlegged 1997 unaired Justice League of America pilot, which has The Flash, Adam, the guy Gardner Green Lantern, Fire and Ice and the Martian Manhunter in it, which is dreadful. It is dreadful. And it was clearly, by that point, you know, think about where we are in 1990, what's going on in 1997. Like, this is really when Seinfeld is becoming, like, the center of the television universe, right? Like, the rise of Seinfeld.
Right.
It was like they, if you can imagine taking that John Wesley Shipp Flash show and someone saying, make this more like an episode of Seinfeld, that's how you get to that.
Oh.
On-air Justice League pilot in 1997. But in between, there were all these treatments and various other versions of the Justice League that they were trying to get made. And I know this because of the magazines that I used to read at the time, like Comic Scene, Comics Interview, where they would talk to, oh, I just wrote a treatment for this, or oh, this is going into pre-production, or oh, this has been rejected. And I was always stunned that in all these various rewrites, you know, they would talk about, we have to put the Flash in there because they want to use the suits that they had built, but we're making it all about Green Arrow. And I thought, if you were going to make a Justice League show, like, who's sitting around going, I don't care who we get, as long as we get Green Arrow.
Right.
That's the guy we need to make the Justice League work.
Of all the people, and maybe that's why it can be as affordable as it can be. Maybe it is. You know,
he doesn't have crazy superpowers, you
right?
know?
And maybe it does come down to special effects. Like, all right, if we're going to do Hawkman, mm-hmm. that probably wouldn't be, you know, we're going to have him flying all the time. We're going to have to worry about his wings on a regular basis. Maybe that's not the best use of our resources. Maybe the Flash. And I was always struck by why that show was so darn expensive, right? Mm-hmm. All you're doing is speeding them up. You and I were doing that with a home video camera around the house. Remember the Flush?
I do.
You and I made a home video called The Flush, mm-hmm. where...
Yeah, well, I don't know what that was based on.
And, like, how would we do that? We would just speed him up with... Or no.
Right, there was just a button on the front of the camera that was like, play it back at double speed, and then we were twice as fast. Like, it was that easy.
Play it back at double speed, and we would add on-screen, like, wavy lines behind
right.
us.
We could draw speed lines behind. Yeah, there was... Right. That was very easy to do. And do you know what our budget was for an episode of The Flush, Clayton? I think it was $0.
It was like a sandwich, and we had to buy red tights. No, our most expensive production ever was when we did our Batman Home movie.
It was very expensive.
We had to buy you green tights to play the Riddler.
We did, yeah.
Which is an incredible Oscar-worthy turn, by the way.
Thank you for that. You know, you and I caught a little heat because you may remember we borrowed a Batman movie cowl from our then mutual friend, Mr. Bob Trait.
Right.
And do you remember why he was so angry with us upon watching the final cut of Batman the Home Movie? Do you remember?
Did it have like a scuff on the horn? Oh, no, I remember, because I, at one scene, climbed through your bedroom window in a rescue attempt.
Yes.
And I was climbing up the outside wall, but because I couldn't, you know, I mean, I was going to die if I jumped out your window, right? So I had to kind of fake it like I was climbing in.
Yes.
But as I was climbing in, I didn't think to like lower my head low enough. Where the bat horns hit the top of the window and bent backwards.
Right.
Oh, boy, did he get angry.
He was hot about that. And, you know, it was rubber. Like,
right.
A second later, they sprung right back into position. But there was a moment of iciness throughout the screening room when Bob Trait saw his bat horns being bent like that for a second. But it's interesting this comes up. And, you know, this is on my mind. I don't know, bearing in mind, of course, the fact that my birthday has just passed and everything else, and about what our station is in life right now, so to speak, this kind of dawned on me about the way you and I grew up, that because we grew up as lovers of the superhero genre, we grew up reading comic books and watching the related cartoons and the shows and the movies and everything else. I think, I don't know, maybe this speaks to a childish part of my imagination, I don't know, or my career path, or both, that you always kind of grow up imagining that you're going to somehow fulfill the childhood fantasies that you have. And I think people do. You know, maybe I'm overestimating people's imaginations. Perhaps that is... I eat too many toaster strudels, and I have an overactive imagination. But the thing about being, and I'm now 36, is that this is really the age where I can no longer grow up to be Batman. And I mean this, think about when we talked to Michael Uslan, whenever that was now, I don't know, 50 episodes ago, whenever he was kind enough to last join us. We talked to him, and there was someone else that we had talked to as well, maybe not even as part of the Grizz, but separate, about the phenomenon of Robin. And that is that, you know, whether it's a corporate executive or whomever, they love the idea of Robin in the comics, in the movies, on the TV show. And the rhetoric that they use to justify Robin is this. They say that the young viewer needs Robin as an entry point to relate to the characters because the young kid wants to be Robin. And you and I both know that's false.
Right.
Kids do not want to be Robin.
Right. Not at all. They want to be Batman.
That's right. And I think part of the reason for that, I don't know if this was Michael Uslan who said this to us or if it was someone else, is that, and I believe this to be 100%, they hit the nail exactly on the head when they said this, a child cannot be Robin because Robin is a child like they are and they're not in a circus. But a child, you know, right? Everyone understands that's the origin of Robin, right? As a child, he was a circus performer. He was an acrobat. That's why he's capable of doing all the things that he's able to do, right? Well, kid's already a kid, and the kid's not a circus acrobat. So I can't be Robin, but I could grow up to be Batman. That's the power of Batman on a child's imagination. And when, especially Batman, and this kind of ties into what we were saying about Green Arrow, in that, Batman and Green Arrow don't have superpowers.
Right.
You know, Green Arrow, one version of his origin story was that he was marooned on an island and had to learn to survive through archery. That's why he became a master archer. But that's it, right? If we really wanted to... Like, I don't know. Like, Clayton could quit his job at Fox and say, for the next 2 years, all I'm going to do is archery.
Right. And until I could then eventually become good, right? The 10,000 hours. Every day I'm shooting bow and arrow, I'd probably be good.
That's right. The Malcolm Gladwellism of the 10,000 hours, right? Eventually, you'd be hitting me with green arrows with boxing gloves on the end, and I'd be like, hey, knock that off. let me just say, by the way, Hawkeye fans, if there isn't a boxing glove arrow in the Avengers movie, we're going to get together afterwards in kibitz. So... But I think that's really powerful for a child's imagination or something about that, that especially the myth of Batman. And part of what made this really spring into my mind just over the last couple of weeks that I've been rolling this around and, of course, my 36th birthday looming large. A couple of weeks ago I talked to some children at the Reading Public Library about the power of El Santo and Mexican Lucha Libre and how that impacted the culture of Mexico. And what's fascinating, to make it relatable to them, to try and give them a real understanding of the significance of El Santo, was to correlate him with Batman. Because Batman is just a human, so to speak, right? He doesn't have superpowers, as we just said. Batman is the height of human potential. He is the ultimately dedicated, the ultimately committed, right? He made himself into a brilliant detective. He made himself into this brilliant hand-to-hand combatant. But did it through sheer force of will and commitment and dedication. There is nothing – and yes, there are people who make that argument, and this is valid that, in the books, of course, Batman's a millionaire, right? But to you and me, and I think to anybody that really understands the core concept of that character, is Batman the Batmobile? Is Batman the Batboat? No. The accessories might be, to an extent, what makes him so cool. You know, the fact that he's got just about every crazy thing you could think of in that utility belt. But ultimately, what Batman's real power is his brain.
Right.
You know? It's the fact that he has that iron will, the fact that he is so dedicated, that he's so committed. And that's a very inspirational idea, I think. I think that is why he translates into so many other forms of media that Superman, who is ultimately more identifiable on a worldwide basis just from his iconography... Superman is always secondary to Batman.
You're right, and that's why I think he's the perfect superhero. And it's funny that my wife was asking me the other day why certain, she was asking me some questions about Batman because we're, explaining it to my son.
Sure. So, did you tell her to shut up?
So don't ever ask me about Batman. In fact, we were watching Spider-Man 2, the movie Spider-Man 2. She's like, I guess I need to gear up for, the new films, and I've never seen Spider-Man 2 or Spider-Man 3.
Mm. Don't need 3, Natalie.
Right, and I told her, I said, look, Spider-Man 2, if you look, you see it in the TV guide listed, it's always listed as like a 4-star film. Mm-hmm. Because it is as close to being a perfect superhero film as there is. But she didn't understand why, she's like, I just don't get it, it's just... He's so comic booky, and I was trying to explain to her like that's it's because that's how he is in the he is a comic book character. Spider-Man right. is a comic book character.
There's a whole universe of comic book characters that are influenced by that version of Spider-Man.
Like, right.
That Marvelism informed decades of comic book superheroes to come because Spider-Man was so original in that way.
And Batman is perhaps the most empathetic superhero. And I think it's the empathy that makes that character so great. I mean, if you had to look at the archetype of a superhero, he may be the perfect archetype. You know, his parents killed, then through, as you point out, sheer force of will, wills himself into not revenge, but justice, and living out, you know, how, what's the best way to say this? His parents' memory by going after criminals, trying to not – what's the word I'm looking at?
Well,
so, liberate.
I don't know that they came out and said this back in the day, but what they've often come back to as a point maybe from like the Denny O'Neill era forward is that Batman sees his own mission as, you know, whatever that was in the books. They said he was 8 years old when his parents were killed. He said, I will serve as a guardian of Gotham so that no other 8-year-old will ever go through what I did.
Right. And you know? So, yeah, it hits on all cylinders. But you're right that he's not – he doesn't have superpowers. And so that's – it's. I'm reminded of that again as I'm reading the new Justice League books, the new 52.
Yeah.
Because they're introducing all of the characters. And it's a real treat. These new Justice League books are a real treat. You know, in each episode, or excuse me, each issue of the new series, they're introducing a new character. At the end, you get this like big splash page of Wonder Woman. You get the end of the next issue, you get this big splash page of Aquaman, and you know I think the first book it was Superman, but throughout the whole all of the books, everyone keeps remarking to Batman, "What do you do? Mm-hmm. You know what?" Wait a minute, you don't have any powers? And Flash can't believe that he has no powers. Superman can't believe that he has no powers. But, you know, it's the fact that he's got a brain and he's the world's greatest detective that it doesn't matter that he doesn't have the powers because he's the brains of the operation.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a classic sense of what you think of as a superhero, Batman, some people would disqualify him because he has no superpowers, right? Like, that's what makes a superhero super, is that he has superpowers.
Right.
But I think ultimately Batman is the ultimate representation of that. The ultimate superhero is what I mean by that. In spite of that, you know, people try to kind of delineate it very rigidly about that. You know, I remember thinking as a kid, I once asked my own dad, I said, "Who is your favorite superhero?" And my father said, "Tarzan." Which was so not the right answer, Dad. And I was just like mystified. Like, what is it? Why him? Like, what is it about him that's attractive? I don't, and I've never understood that. And maybe I never read like the Tarzan novels. Like, the greatest point of familiarity I have with Tarzan was that long running daily comic strip. You know, the three panels at a time, where the first one recaps what just happened, the second panel is the only plot advancement, and the third is what's coming tomorrow. Like, you know, that was a very painful way to experience a character. But
I did see your dad recently. He did revise his favorite superhero. Now he's a big fan of Kraven the Hunter. So he's advanced a little bit.
Kraven's not even a hero, Dad. Yeah. He's a villain. But
he's turned.
I so thought you were going to be like the Spectre. You know, like somebody that's really like the Watcher.
Moon Knight.
but anyway, yeah, I think that is what I was trying to say really about that. You know, when you come to that age where you realize I'm not going to grow up to be Batman. The great thing about Batman as an inspirational figure for anybody is that unlike Superman, right, who his circumstances are unrelatable, right? He was rocketed from a doomed planet somewhere else and was adopted, right? Like, you can't relate to that. Or some alien hasn't come from space and chosen me from all the billions of people on Earth to carry this all-powerful weapon ring. You know, those kinds of things are outside of our ability to control. I can't make my life into that. I can't, you know, be working in a police lab and lightning strikes and hits all the chemicals in front of me and I wake up and I have super speed. I can't make that happen. But any of us could be Batman, you know, if only we really applied ourselves to that ideal, to the same ideal that he did. And that's a really powerful concept, I think. And I think that's why, you know, going back to that conversation that we had with Michael Uslan or whoever it was that really pointed that out, that's why he is so powerful, especially with young imaginations, because it's entirely possible to aim yourself that way. You know what I mean? Like, it is not... Right. I mean, not to be crude about it, but like, unless, for example, you suffer from maybe like a certain type of disability that would make you think I could never grow up to be that. Like, the only thing that really stops you is your own dedication. That's really all that that's the difference between him and anybody else.
It's true. I mean, in a non-superhero way of looking at it, I was talking with my wife the other day on our long drive.
Did you tell her to shut up?
I told her, I am Batman. Despite what you keep thinking, I am. Right. When I disappear at night right. for many hours at a time, mm-hmm. I am out fighting crime.
What's that rubber body armor under your black zip-up, Clayton? And you said, Natalie, shut up.
It's rubber. That's all you need to know. we were talking about you know, I was down in South by Southwest at the big, you know, festival there mm-hmm. in Austin, Texas. And God, there were so many startup companies and all of these different people running around basically trying to show off their company to get media attention or just some sort of attention about their app. You know, maybe they had badges to even have a booth in the convention hall, or maybe they didn't. I mean, the real story was that these people that had no badges, you know, we don't need mm-hmm. no stinking badges. We're out mm-hmm. here. And we're going to try to stand on the street corner and call attention to ourselves. You know, all the sorts of different companies doing different strange things. You know, like one Japanese company, they dressed up in these weird yellow outfits and running around with underwear on their heads to get people to pay attention to what they were doing. And, you know, it's where Twitter started. It's where Foursquare started at South by Southwest. So, obviously, there is the mass amount of people there. But I just remarked at how incredible it was, the will of these individuals to create their own companies, you know, to come up with an idea, meet the right people, draw it up, you know, draw up a business plan, however they were going to do it, meet the right individuals, develop an app, build a company, hire individuals, manage to find venture capital money, launch it, and then hope that, you know, people will buy it or get on board. And then if they fail, they fail forward, you know, and then they try something else. And I was thinking about my friends who started Gizmodo.com, Ryan Block and Peter Rojas. Then they started Engadget.com. They left that after, you know, as a startup, and then they founded another company called GDGT.com, what they call Gadget.com now. And I'm like thinking, you have three startups. How did you pull that off? And they've all been successes. You know, they've all done very, very well. It's remarkable. And so in maybe not in the superhero way of looking at it, that's almost like, you know, these guys are like Batman. I'm like, I'm so impressed by people who just don't take no for an answer. You know, say to themselves, you know what, I'm not going to go 8-to-5 job and work for the man. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do it on my own, even if there are some lean years, I'm going to do it. And then they sort of strike out on their own. So in that way, that might be a good speech to give relating to those kids. I mean, you know, hopefully that drove home something to them. Because I think as we get older, you start to relate. You're like, well, I really can't create a bat cave, mm-hmm. right? I can't get a Batmobile and go out at night and fight crime, but I can create my own podcasting network.
I can aim much lower.
Right, right.
Well, when I got to the end of my long-winded blah, 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 the first question, you know, of course, you know, their mouths were agape. And eyes glazed over. And then one boy in the back raised his hand and asked, have you ever wrestled The Undertaker? And I think that's how I knew that I really hit home.
That's pretty cool, actually.
The answer to which is no.
Yeah. Oh, well.
No.
But you have wrestled. And hey, you created your own wrestling company. You know, you look at that. Look at that.
Indeed, I have. And it does, you know, it is a source of pride for me, especially... having recently moved into these new digs at Chikara Wrestle Factory, which is that training school we alluded to about an hour ago, and you know, getting to see as we're ready to bring on, I think, a new wave of potential trainees. Like this is it, you know. It's season 11 of what we're doing, and I am amazed that it continues to stand. I'm amazed, especially now, to look back on the humble beginnings when it was just a matter of trying to keep your head above water to where we are now. It never ceases to amaze me the things that I've been fortunate enough to observe and be part of over the years. So I think before we move on, and in a moment here, Clayton has something he wants to say about Orthodox Judaism, we should take a moment and pause to say something about Cobra. Clayton, do you know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, you talk about Cobra. I'm going to go plant a plate in my backyard.
Fair enough. Our friends over at Cobra Electronics, they are makers of a number of incredible gizmos that will simplify your life. That's what they're out there to do. Sometimes they're doing it in ways you didn't even realize. The Cobra Tag is a great example thereof. If you know someone or you yourself frequently misplace your smartphone or your keys, the Cobra Tag system is ideal for you because it's a two-way locator system that, using a free app, syncs them together. So if you ever misplace your keys, you can call them from your smartphone to locate them. The things these guys come up with, it's no surprise that they're industry leaders, for one. It's no surprise that they win all the awards that they do, especially when you look at something like their Cobra Eye Radar system, which is a navigation system that gives you up-to-date real-time laser, radar, and red light detection, unlike anything else. This sleek, compact device, which you can stick right on your dashboard, pairs through Bluetooth technology with your smartphone, and using the free app and the dashboard therein, you customize it. So if you want to know anytime you're passing through an intersection where there's a red light camera, for example, whatever type of safety or driving hazard info you want on your trip, you can get through Cobra Eye Radar. And I know this firsthand because sometimes I'm traveling late at night and I often travel by myself. It makes you more alert. It makes you a safer driver, whether you're by yourself or you're traveling with your whole family. It doesn't matter. It's going to make you safer and more alert. It is the driving companion for you or the frequent traveler in your life. Great ideas for you, great gift ideas for others await you when you visit our show sponsors and friends over at Cobra.com. Those are our buddies.
Yeah, thanks to Cobra. We appreciate them. They are fantastic, and we know that many of you have partaken in all of the fantastic things that they offer, and they're always making new stuff, and they've got something really cool that I got a chance to check out while I was in Austin, by the way, for Android phones. So we'll tell you about that next week on the show. Really exciting what they've been doing at Cobra. These guys are fantastic.
Now, Clayton, listen, you know, apart from our appearances here at the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe, that is not the only place you could catch us. If you didn't have enough of us today, Friday, I'll be back with Daddy on Board, which is a parenting podcast from a father's point of view. It has recently become more ranterific. Come over and see me on the Daddy on Board. Also on Sundays, I team up with the aforementioned Natalie for the Trending Show, where we discuss the trending topics that week from Google and Twitter. Now, on the weekends, Clayton also keeps himself quite busy, don't you?
I do indeed. You can always catch me on Fox and Friends on the Fox News channel, and always a great time over there. 4 hours, Saturday and Sunday, where we cover the world. We cover the world everywhere from...
Is that it? Just the world?
It's the world. And, you know, occasionally, actually, we did... we'll cover Mars. I think a few weeks ago we did something about Mars. It was the closest it's been in a while.
Yeah, Pluto, just a dwarf planet now. Just a quick update for you.
Yeah.
This weekend, if you want to come out and see me live, well, I'd love to see you. I'll be wrestling in the Greater Toronto Area this Saturday, in Vaughan, Ontario, to be quite specific. Sunday, I am in the nation's capital of Ottawa. Next month, in April, I'm all over the place. You can catch me everywhere from Rahway, New Jersey, to Lafayette, Indiana. I'll be in Chicago, Illinois, so on and so forth, especially as May draws near, which will mark with our anniversary shows the close of the 10th complete year of Chikara. And of course, it's only apropos that we close it out where everything began, in the Lehigh Valley of Pennsylvania. We will be back at the Palmer Center in Easton on May 19th on that particular night. If you've been thinking about coming out to see us, all kids admitted free to the anniversary show. So that's a great time to come out and see us. It is appropriate for the entire family and will never insult your intelligence. A good time to be had by all at Chikara.
Did you guys just start that on the no insulting intelligence thing? Because You've been insulting my intelligence for years.
I was going to say, for a while there, I would only send Clayton the DVDs that I thought would insult his intelligence.
Right.
He's just like, what the heck? You know, just... He's like, the Earth hasn't been flat in centuries.
I don't get this.
So, but, and that has been a lot... Yeah, it's been a lot of flat Earth rhetoric and a lot of misinformation about Pangea. But we've moved on. This is season 11, Clayton. We're doing a lot of new stuff.
Oh, good. Yeah. So, I never understood Pangea, right? Like, why did Africa nuzzle up next to South America? It never made sense to me. And where does Madagascar fit into this whole thing?
I think that's a type of vanilla syrup, Clayton. I don't think that's even a I don't even think that's a place.
Oh, speaking of it, oh man, I miss those blizzards. You and I were at Dairy Queen the other day.
Oh my God. When we got back, what a weird couple of days I had. When we got back from that, I was so full from whatever you made me eat when we were at that Dairy Queen, right? And I kept saying, Clayton, no more ice cream. I'm sitting here at my desk late in the afternoon, early evening, and I just fell asleep. Like,
did you
it was as if I had consumed so much ice cream that my body was like, we're going to shut down all other life support functions. Redirect all the dilithium crystal power to the stomach to achieve digestion.
It was either that or the DVT. You had deep, it was a deep vein thrombosis while you were sitting there at the computer.
It might have been the deep vein thrombosis. Yeah, so then I conked out for a couple hours at my desk.
Wow.
And, but, you know, if you don't – I don't usually nap. I don't need a nap. I'm getting there soon. But then ever since then, like all the couple of days since I've seen you, since we had that huge meal at Dairy Queen, have been so out of whack because I had that weird nap. You know, then I was up really late, way later than I should have been up. Then the next day I was all super tired. Like, I'm all out of whack from that extra digestive nap those three or four ice cream treats you made me eat, and then the box of Dilly bars was too much.
And the Ambien I slipped in your blizzard. Oh, no, that was my doll. It was hard to tell. No, it's funny because I had said to you, hey, let's just, you know, I don't know, meet for coffee because you didn't have a lot of time. I said, let's. Right. You said, it's a barren wasteland. There's no coffee places anywhere. Meanwhile, there was a Starbucks and a brand new Dunkin' Donuts right there.
I couldn't see those.
But you're like, all right, but there's also a Dairy Queen. So we met at Dairy Queen. I'm like, all right, now I'm forced to have for lunch ice cream. This is the Mike. This is the Quackenbush diet.
He was forced to have ice cream for lunch.
Strong.
Forced.
You put me in an arm bar and a dilly bar.
That's what we should call that, the dilly bar. I'm going to send a text message to the ice creams when we're done. Actually, the dilly bar finisher is coming. Go ahead.
But it was delicious, though. I haven't had one of those, I think, honestly, since you and I,
Pagoda
years
Comics
ago.
Days.
We used to go down to Pagoda Comics, and we'd stop at Dairy Queen every stinking day and get blizzards. Mm. I used to get the Butterfinger Blizzard all the time. Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah.
Let me tie this back for you. Do you know where I sold the rest of my Secret Wars action figures?
On eBay? Did I just buy one back?
I would have never sold that Falcon. No, I sold them to Keith Biscani's mom at Pagoda Comics all those years ago, so we had Dairy Queen money. So we've really come full circle.
That is fantastic. So one right down the tubes. You got nothing from them. All those figures you sold. That's so sad.
It is.
Oh, so sad. Have you had a chance to listen? One of the other things I got for you was the Monkees headquarters sessions. Did you get a chance to listen to that yet?
No, let me tell you, though. I did recently bring that into my iTunes specifically so I could enjoy it. And you know what? Those tracks are now gone from my iPad. Mm. And that was the topic of a 20-minute conversation you and I had before we started recording The Grizz.
All right, I'll see you, everyone. Bye-bye.
So we've really come full circle now. Not only did we get back to the Secret Wars figure, we got all the way back to our pre-show discussion about why these things aren't on my iPad.
But we'll figure that out. I'll get to the bottom of that.
Let the mystery be. The mystery be. So I think we really covered it here, so let's not linger. I suspect we'll be back next week with more of this.
Indeed. Let's not let it linger. In fact, the Cranberries out with a new album.
Mm-hmm.
All right, everyone. We'll see you next week on The Grizz. See you, man. And happy birthday.